evening. Welcome to Co-op Radio, CFR 102.7 FM. This is another edition of Stark Raven. Stark Raven takes a closer look at prisons and the politics of criminalization, and we are here on Co-op Radio the first three Mondays of each month from 7 until 8 p.m. My name is Emily Aspinwall, and I'll be your host for today's show. In the next hour, we have a special documentary presentation honoring 35 years since the Attica prison uprising. We also have news on Palestinian prisoners, a fence on the U.S.-Mexico border, animal rights activists convicted of terrorism. Later in the show, we also have a report on companies profiting off of increasing immigration detention in the United States, and words from Leonard Peltier on his 62nd birthday. We have music by David Robix, and community announcements we'll have for you at the end of the show. Lots of things going on in and around town, so stay tuned to Stark Raven the next hour.
This week on Making Contact.
As long as you take a man or a woman and treat him as a beast, you're going to always have a problem. It's the most cruel and unhuman punishment and treatment that any person can be exposed to.
September 13th marks the anniversary of the Attica prison rebellion, massacre, and cover-up. The story of Attica is one of the most brutal and heroic chapters in U.S. history. After a five-day occupation, 45 people were killed, 150 were shot, and hundreds were tortured. As one slogan from 1971 read, "Attica is all of us." Currently, with more than 2 million people imprisoned in the U.S. today, the story of Attica needs to be told. On this edition, we present a documentary produced by the Freedom Archives and narrated by Rhonda Ramiro. And I'm Tina Rubio, your host for Making Contact, a program connecting people, battle ideas, and important information.
So when they speak about revolution, they must speak about a change, because we are human beings, and we got to be treated like human beings.
We are men! We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
If you put people under these kind of conditions, they're going to rebel, you know, and that's what Attica teaches you.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
On this program, you will hear the voices of prisoners, including L.D. Barkley, a prison leader who proclaimed the Attica Manifesto to the world and was killed during the massacre. You'll also hear Frank Big Black Smith, who survived the massacre and describes the torture that took place in its aftermath. You'll also hear other prisoners and guards taken hostage during the five-day occupation, as well as Elizabeth Fink and Michael Deutsch, two attorneys among many who defended prisoners charged with the rebellion, gained acquittals and clemencies, then brought and eventually settled damage suits on behalf of the prisoners. Like all mass rebellions, the Attica Rebellion was preceded by a long chain of abuses, years of petition and protest to improve conditions, years of false promises of reform by the prison administration.
We felt that the people should come together and get a better understanding of the conditions here, what was being did to them by the administration.
Attica brother, Donald Noble.
So behind this, we would hold meetings in the yard. You know, we'd hold an open house, and whoever wanted to come to listen to our political ideology, they were welcome. We didn't bar anyone. This was frowned on by the institution, and they would break it up. In order to reach everyone, we had to get along with different factions here, the Muslims and the Five Percenters and all the other factions, to become one solid movement. We start talking about a strike. They made a lot of promises about the conditions would be better, the food would get better, and medical conditions would be better. It was a lot of promises. So everyone laid, they waited, you know. And nothing was did. This is when the Attica Liberation Faction began. We wanted to do things diplomatically, you know. We were seeking reform, although many were not in favor of reform because they didn't believe that the people would listen. So we sought support from the entire population.
People were not interested in waiting for change. They wanted to make change.
Attorney Elizabeth Fink.
The prisoners themselves had gone through a number of different routes to try and change the barbaric conditions that were at Attica. The fact that they were forced to work in the metal shop at 107, 108 degrees for 56 cents a day. The fact that most people were Muslims and the major meat that was given was pork. There was no educational programs. There were no third world guards. There was no representation in any kind of parole hearings. There was just nothing. And the situation in the New York State prisons, as in every other prison in every other state, was deeply racist. All the guards were white, and the vast majority of the prisoners were third world. And up until about 1969, at Attica, for example, everybody stays in their block. They eat with their block, they work with their block, and they wreck with their block. And there's only one day a year where you open up the prison, and that was the 4th of July. And they had this institution called Black Ice and White Ice. They'd bring out this ice, and it was white ice, and only the white people could use it. And then they'd bring out this other ice, and it was black ice. That was only the black people. And this lasted until, like, 69.
In the months preceding September 9, 1971, prisoners had written a manifesto protesting conditions and listing grievances. There had been no response from the administration. Then, on August 21, 1971, prison movement leader and writer George Jackson was shot down at San Quentin Prison in California.
Things were getting worse. What really solidified things was George Jackson's death. This had a reaction on the people that we were trying to accomplish all along to bring them together. We thought of, well, how could we pay tribute to George Jackson, because a lot of us idolized him, the things that he was doing, the things he was exposing about the system. So we decided that we would have a silent fast that whole day in honor of him. We would wear black armbands. No one was to eat anything that whole day. We noted that if the people could come together for this, and they could come together for other things.
I didn't know anything about, you know, George Jackson. What George Jackson? So we were going to trial that morning, and when we got in the mess, everything was quiet. Nobody saying nothing. And you talking about 500, 600, 700 people, inmates. Nobody was eating. So I asked one of my buddies, Carlos, I said, what's up, man? He said, shh, be cool, guy. I said, I didn't tell you, man. This dude, George Jackson, in California, killing, and man, there's some kind of solidarity. Ain't nobody eating. But then it went away. I didn't eat. We sat down, but it was, woo.
And so they saw the effect of that mass action, joint action, on the administration and the guards, which was total terror. And I believe that it empowered them.
It was a seemingly small repressive incident against a black and white prisoner that triggered the occupation itself. The tensions of the past years and months erupted into a rebellion by prisoners from four cell blocks and the occupation of D Yard by over 1,500 prisoners. Black, Puerto Rican, Native American, and white prisoners joined together over 5 days, proclaiming demands, caring for guards held hostage, and naming a number of prominent progressive activists, lawyers, and journalists as intermediaries as negotiations began. L.D. Barkley read their manifesto.
The entire incident that has erupted here at Attica is not a result of the dastardly bushwhacking of the two prisoners September 8th of 1971, but of the unmitigated oppression wrought by the racist administrative network of this prison throughout the year. We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disregard for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States. What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed. We will not compromise on any terms except those terms that are agreeable to us. We call upon all the conscientious citizens of America to assist us in putting an end to this situation that threatens the lives of not only us, but of each and every one of you. We have set forth demands that will bring us closer to the reality of the demise of these prison institutions that serve no useful purpose to the people of America, but to those who would enslave and exploit the people of America.
The manifesto's been gone out 3-4 months, and nothing has happened. And as I say, the conditions, they just got worse, man.
These prisoners in front of the whole world organized a structure where they had elections in the blocks and people who represented them and a conglomeration of white people and black people and brown people, all of whom were empowered. And everybody got to watch that over the 5 days, and it was really intense.
Our demands are such. We want complete amnesty, meaning freedom from all and any physical, mental, and legal reprisals. We want now speedy and safe transportation out of confinement to a non-imperialistic country. We demand that the federal government intervene so that we will be under direct federal jurisdiction. We want the governor and the judiciary to guarantee that there will be no reprisals. And we want all facets of the media to articulate this. We guarantee the safe passage of all people to and from this institution. We invite all the people to come here and witness this degradation so that they can better know how to bring this degradation to an end. This is what we want.
During the occupation, interviews were conducted with prisoners and with guards held hostage.
These people in here are treated like dogs. Not only the black, the Puerto Rican, the black, and the white.
Right on.
And I want everyone to know that we're going to stick together, that we're going to get what we want, or we're going to die here. Let all of them.
My name is Johnny Delgado. I'm a Puerto Rican, and I'm proud to be a Puerto Rican. And I've always been proud to be a Puerto Rican. Now, I'm going to lay it on you the way it is. These people here, I'm trying to kill us. All these dogs up there with all those rifles are trying to kill us. But we ain't going to quit. You know, we're not, why are we not going to quit? Because we're one. We're one unit. We're tired of being beaten. We're tired of being oppressed. We're going to get this if we all have to die. All of us.
What is your name, please?
Frank Straw.
What is your job?
Correction officer.
Now, we want to know exactly what do you think of the way you're treated in here by these men?
We all have been treated 100%. Been fed well, gave us blankets, slept on mattresses while they slept on the ground. Medication was given to us while they didn't get any. They took care of us first. We've been taken care of at least 100%.
How do you think these men should be treated henceforth?
I think they should be treated 150%. I know they have grievances. I know because I work with them. They've got grievances. I know these grievances. We have to tell those people out there about them.
We all wish we could be home. By we, I don't mean 38 of us. I mean all of us. All 1,538 of us.
To the oppressed people all over the world, we have the solution. The solution is unity.
I'd like to speak to the brothers in Buffalo. And I want you brothers to get together because we together here. And these people think we shucking and jiving, but we is for real. We are as serious as cancer. We are for real.
Noted radical attorney William Kunstler, one of the intermediaries named by the prisoners, was interviewed just outside Attica State Prison on September 13, 1971. His words proved prophetic.
The commissioner told us last night that he was going through his own ordeal and that he had not made his mind what to do. We implore him, as we implore him now, to have no force in there. They want to continue to talk. If they go in there, it's going to be a massacre in this prison, and it's on the heads of the authorities if it takes place. And I have nothing but the greatest of sympathy both for the guards and for the inmates inside. Time can produce something here, but a loss of time and a show of force will produce only death and misery, not only here, but I'm sure we'll have a reaction in black ghettos and other areas throughout the country.
Well, is Governor Rockefeller going to come here? Will he consider doing that? Do you think he should come here?
He should come. His refusal to come here is a monstrosity, because what he is saying is, kill these men. I have no concern. All I want to do is restore law and order. And I think that's a rotten exchange for lives.
Now, one of the observations. What if the observation helicopters is taken off, and with it, now for the first time, one of the large army helicopters is taken off. It is known that the army helicopters are loaded with what is called riot gas, though we're not quite sure what kind of gas it is. Anyway, here come the helicopters, and they are now heading for the prison. One of the large army helicopters now going overhead and over the wall into the prison. Any idea what's going on behind this cover of gas?
I think we're about to witness a massacre. We just tried a man for My Lai and convicted him, and now My Lai number two is taking place. That is an absolute act of bestiality on the part of this man who calls himself an elected official of this state. I hope that the black people of America and the Puerto Rican people of America remember this day.
The helicopter came and dropped the CS gas, and at the exact moment that gas was dropped, they started to shoot. Exactly at that moment, and they cleared the catwalks. They just murdered everybody on the catwalk.
It was a slaughter line, man. It was people were defenseless. All right, they had sticks. Homemade weapons to defend themselves, but this doesn't compare, man, with magnums and carbines. Well, this is ridiculous, you know? The next thing I know is this big helicopter flying over us, and tear gas is coming from everywhere. It's a whole lot of shooting carrying on. So naturally, everyone is running for cover, you know? So I'm next to the wall, and I know around me that everyone is hiding their face, and guys are spitting rags and putting it to their nose. But what I know was troopers start coming from everywhere. Then I start seeing different people fall. You know, they were shot. Guys was losing their hands, shot in the head and the neck.
The power structure, led by Nelson Rockefeller,
attorney Elizabeth Fink,
wanted to show to the world, and certainly to the rebellious forces within his own country, with the advice and consent and affirmation of Richard Nixon, what the price is for rebellion. And so they created this assault force, which was there to murder everybody. There were 4,500 rounds of ammunition fired on a cage of people, and there were 1,289 people in it. They used high-powered rifles with dum-dum bullets that entered and exploded on impact. And they used shotguns with 8 to 12 36 caliber bullets with an indiscriminate 50-yard spread. And the reason why they did all that is because they wanted to kill a lot of people.
You're listening to a special documentary, The Attica Rebellion, produced by the Freedom Archives. We'll have more in a few moments. This is Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information, or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to The Attica Rebellion, with the voice of attorney Michael Deutsch.
The state came in with an incredible amount of firepower. The prisoners were essentially unarmed, only had makeshift weapons. After they shot people down, people who were surrendering with their hands in their head, who were lying prone on the ground, were shot. People who were running away were shot in the back. They then proceeded to strip everybody and send them through lines of swinging guards with clubs.
They had officers lined up all in the hall, everywhere. You know, you were scared to death because you were stripped naked, you know. All you seen and heard was a lot of nasty words, calling you all kinds of niggas, you know. They calling the black niggas, they calling the white niggas, they calling the Puerto Rican niggas, and so forth, you know.
And took the leaders who they believe were the leaders of the negotiations and put X's on their back.
When I was placed before the war, they put an X on my back. We theorized that this was intentionally done, man, to exterminate us. You know, the state troopers said that if we moved, we were dead people, you know, dead men.
Literally tortured many of them and put them in cells nude, some with bullet wounds still in them. Many didn't get medical care. Many died from bleeding to death because they didn't get proper medical care, even though they knew prior to the time of the assault that they were going to come in that way. They only provided ambulances for the hostages. They had one ambulance for each hostage and no ambulances for the wounded prisoners.
They would line up on two sides. As you would come down, they would hit you with the sticks and the guns, you know, spit at you. If you fall down, four of them would come on top of you and start beating you with the back of the rifle butts, you know. Once you got in the cell, they take you out of the cell. They give you a beat and throw you back in the cell. They wouldn't feed you. When they did feed you, they put their hands in the food, spit in the food, stuff like that, right in front of you, you know. They'd come down and wake you up every few minutes for harassment, shake on the bars, get up, you know. They wouldn't let you sleep. This went on for days. Left the windows open, no clothes, no shoes.
The mass murder that took place on the 13th of September. Cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Attica brother, Frank Big Black Smith.
I am telling you what I seen with my own eyes. I speak of my dead brother, L.D. Barkley. I know for a fact that he was premeditatedly murdered. I know this.
I was taken out of the yard, and I was put on a table, nude. My body, at present, have cigar burns, cigarette burns all over it. My testicles, at times, bother me now from cigarette butts, sticks, rifles, laying on the table with my head looking up at the catwalk being spit on, hot shells thrown on my body. I tried to cover up with my pillow. Can you imagine 250 pounds getting under a pillow? State troopers and police came by and said, nigga, get out from under that pillow. We wanted you to have a cover. We would give you one. You gonna die in the morning, nigga, so it don't make no difference. Nowhere, whether you freeze or we kill you. Nigga, black power, huh? Black power, huh? That's all was said to me while I was in that room. Trying to make me be the animal that he is. To reverse the victim to the criminal to the victim.
What happened after Attica, which was that you have this horrendous event where 43 people were killed, where 150 were shot, and where 1,289 were tortured. And the state then spent the next 30 years trying to cover it up. The story of that, of course, is unbelievable. They took bulldozers and they bulldozed the evidence in the yard, which is all the casings and the shotguns and all of the evidence of their murders. They never noted who got one gun. They didn't follow any of the procedures which you're supposed to when you're about to use deadly force, right? Because they didn't want to. All they wanted is for these people to be blown away. And that's what happened. They got blown away.
So the first thing that had to be done was to defend the prisoners. There were 60 prisoners charged with over 1,400 felony counts. So lawyers came from all across the country to set up a Attica Brothers legal defense and essentially put on a coordinated defense to stop the criminal charges. There was a big political movement that worked with the lawyers who said, jail the real criminals, indict Rockefeller, and drop all the charges.
They spent $158 million prosecuting 62 inmates on 42 indictments, the largest set of indictments in the history of the United States.
And after many years of struggle, we were able to get all the charges dropped, but a few, and there were clemency given to the few that were convicted.
So after we fought the indictments, then we decided we needed to file a civil suit. And in 1974, we filed a civil suit asking the state of New York to pay us money for the shooting, the murders, and the torture.
And it took us essentially 20 years to begin to tell those stories in court. There was just a tremendous amount of delays caused by the state. The state hired private lawyers who were paid millions of dollars. And after 20 years, we were able to get the case to trial in 91 and 92. And after a five-month trial in which many of the brothers testified, in which National Guard, who came in to help with the medical care, testified, doctors testified, even one or two state police testified, and some correctional guards testified, a jury of people from Buffalo all agreed that the assault itself inflicted cruel and unusual punishment, as well as the reprisals after the assault.
So we were in a catch-22, because the real issue was always whether what happened to them, which was so horrendous, transcended who they were, a bunch of rebellious third world convicts. And in front of regular people, just like us in Buffalo, racist, bad, the answer was yes.
That became a big thing. If a jury in Buffalo can have that kind of education and knowledge about who was wrong and who was right, because the people in the community really, really, really upheld the law.
And so the case went up on appeal, and in what is easily one of the most dishonest decisions that had ever been written, the Court of Appeal reversed all of our verdicts. What we had was a class action, and so we were able to file one suit for everybody who was in DER at the time the shooting started. What the appellate court said was that it was not an appropriate case for a class action, and that we would have to do each case individually. So what that meant is we would have to do 1,286 cases rather than one. And after 26 years, 29 or however many years ago, we just did not have the ability to do that. Right. And so therefore, they forced us to take $12 million, right, which was an inadequate settlement, but the largest settlement in the history of the American prison movement, but still not justice by any means.
Three juries then found, after hearing the evidence, that there were violations of human rights and constitutional rights, but it was the judicial system, the courts, the men who decide the law, which prevented us from getting justice, essentially. It was not the people who heard the evidence.
As long as you take a man, a person, a woman, and treat them as a beast, you're gonna always have a problem in these concentration camps. Because what is happening in these institutions is the most cruel and unhuman punishment and treatment that any person can be exposed to.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be beaten or driven as such.
People must know that we are dying. We are being murdered every day. That is what's happening in here, in all the Atticas over the world.
The powers that be knew exactly what they were doing. They knew what weapons they were using. They knew what police force were they doing. They wanted that scorching. They could have taken over that yard without a shot, but they didn't want that. They wanted all that carnage, so everybody will see what happens when you rebel.
What has happened here is but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed.
Oppressed people, people without power, can make a difference. They were able to get the eyes of the world to look at the prison system and to look at Attica. They sacrificed, in many cases, their lives to do it, but you never give up, and you continue to fight, and you continue to try and expose injustice and make sure that human rights violators can never rest easy.
What I see is this for the people in the street. I see, wake up. Stop hiding. Because the same thing is happening to me is happening to you. And deal. Petition. Rallies. Let the people, let the governor, let the president and people that in a position to do something about this know how you feel about your sons and your daughters that's incarcerated. Other than that, wake up, because nothing comes to a sleeper but a dream.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. You've just heard The Attica Rebellion, a documentary created in honor of the September 13, 1971 Attica Prison Rebellion and Massacre. The documentary was produced by the Freedom Archives with the assistance of a grant from the Paul Robeson Fund. Thanks to narrator Rhonda Ramiro, Attica ex-prisoner Frank Big Black Smith, and Attica attorneys Elizabeth Fink and Michael Deutsch. The Freedom Archive producers were Lincoln Bergman, Anita Johnson, Andrea Lessler, and Claude Marks. For more information on this program, please go to freedomarchives.org. To listen to other programs in the Making Contact series, please visit radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Dorian Taylor, communications manager, and I'm your host and senior producer, Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
I'm a good cook, right, man? Chili peppers, yeah, I'll take them. And juicy birds, all right, I'll bake them. Make up a soup, yum, yum, so we all can move along like culture. What's done is done, goodbye congestion. I just got one simple suggestion. Forsake the answer, rename the question. What lies deep enough not to be mentioned should be brought to the top to be spoken. Even though you may have been real heartbroken, feel like your brains and your blood's been soaking in a pool of regret. You just haven't gone for your truth yet, right? Right.
I resolve to find the truth. Speak words that carry. I resolve to find the truth. Speak words that free me. I resolve to find the truth. Speak words that carry. I resolve to find the truth. Speak words that carry. And then my legs can move freely. And then the world doesn't pull me over. Then I'm grown enough to see. I'm 24, even more. Knock down my shelf door.
That was some Kinney Starr off her album Sun Again. That was the track Soar. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Stark Raven, and we'll be back in a moment with the news. And it's time now for the news on Stark Raven, and we have a special news host today. Marge Lamb's joining us, and she'll be joining us and reading some news.
The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that would create a massive fence on the U.S.-Mexico border. The bill calls for the construction of 700 miles of double-layered fencing along several sections of the border. The bill also increases other border security measures. It gives border agents new authority to stop fleeing vehicles. It also calls for a study to determine the need for a fence on the Canadian-U.S. border. The U.S.-Mexico border is nearly 2,000 miles long. It currently has about 75 miles of fencing. The bill does not include funding for the fence. Cost estimates range between $2 and $7 billion. The fence bill is the first phase of a larger border security package recently unveiled. The broader package would increase the number of Border Patrol agents, step up prosecution of those who help migrants cross the border, and criminalize the building of tunnels under the border. The bill still needs to pass through the U.S. Senate before becoming law.
Three people are the first to face prison sentences under a new U.S. Anti-Terrorism Act targeting animal rights activists. The three are members of a group called Stop Huntingdon Animal Cruelty. They organized to drive Huntingdon Life Sciences out of business. That company tests pharmaceuticals, chemicals, and dyes on a range of animals. The three were found guilty of violating the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. This U.S. federal law was amended in 2002 to equate its offenses with terrorism. This was the first trial and conviction under that law. The three were not accused of directly making threats or carrying out vandalism, but they were convicted of using their website to incite threats and harassments against the company. They are facing prison sentences of between 4 and 6 years. They were also ordered to pay a total of $1 million U.S. in restitution to the company and some of its employees. Three others were also convicted on the same charges and are still awaiting sentencing. All of them are planning on appealing the convictions. The Stop Huntingdon Animal Cruelty group said the sentences would not deter them from protesting against Huntingdon.
Israeli forces have closed a Palestinian prisoner support headquarters in the West Bank. A large contingent of soldiers stormed the offices of the Palestinian Prisoner Society and confiscated computers and files. An Israeli administrative order declared the Palestinian Prisoner Society an illegal organization and ordered it to shut down for at least 2 years. The Prisoner Society is calling on international human rights organizations to pressure Israel to reverse the shutdown order and respect the autonomy of human rights groups.
One quarter of all Palestinians living in the occupied territories have been imprisoned by Israel in the last 6 years. More than 50,000 residents have been in an Israeli prison at one point since the beginning of the recent Intifada. 10,000 people remain in prison. This includes dozens of people who've spent years in administrative detention without charges. During those 6 years, almost 200 people have died as a result of torture or medical neglect in Israeli jails. And that's the end of the news here on Stark Raven. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. This is Stark Raven. We are here the first 3 Mondays of each month from 7 till 8 p.m. And our program focuses on the issues of prison and the politics of criminalization. We go now to a feature on expanding immigrant detentions that are profitable for the prison industry. This piece was produced by Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff recently paid a visit to the rural Texas county of Willacy. He was there to hail the opening of 500 new beds in an immigration detention facility. The new beds, which are already at full capacity, are in tent domes built by private contractor Hale Mills. As Leanne Caldwell from Free Speech Radio News reports, prison expansion adds up to big business for the prison industry.
In the 1990s, incarceration rates dipped. That hurt business. Private companies that owned and operated prisons saw falling profits and little opportunity for growth. But they found hope in the rise of immigration detention. It became a central focus of immigration law in the 90s, and especially since September 11, 2001. Christopher Nugent is an immigration attorney for the Women's Commission.
This is where people are seeing the growth in the prison industry with immigration detainees.
There are 300 detention centers around the country, but only 9 of them are run and operated by the Department of Homeland Security purely as detention centers. The rest are added on to privately owned prisons or jails. Christopher Nugent says this results in the prisoner-like treatment of immigrants.
Detention is not intended to be punitive, but the trend has, the industry has grown this way and it's taken on dynamics of its own.
39-year-old immigrant from Jamaica, Patrick Brown, said he was treated like a prisoner and worse.
And I was beaten down for smoking a cigarette by a good squad. And I was in my cell smoking when the lieutenant opened the door, slapped me in my face, and quickly come 5 other officers that start kick, stomp me, beat me. Drag me outside the cell, continue beat on me, handcuff me on the ground, take me off the ground, fling me up against the wall, pepper spray me. Then I was put back in the cell for like 20 minutes with the handcuff on my hand for no given reason.
When Patrick was picked up on attempted assault and larceny charges, his legal status was stripped. That's an effect of the 1996 immigration laws. He was then sent to detention centers throughout Louisiana, where he languished for more than 5 years. He is partially paralyzed and says he was never treated for his injuries. DHS has policies and standards for treatment of immigrant detainees, but they're non-binding. Andrea Black, director of Detention Watch Network in Washington, D.C., says that means they're often broken.
They do have a system where they are trying to, you know, do an annual review to see if these facilities meet the requirements. But in the cases of abuse and the cases of, you know, substandard conditions, there's really no legally enforceable way to make sure that they're actually upheld.
For breaking the law, Patrick was shipped back to Jamaica this past June, where he says he's barely living. He has no family and no government support. His wife and 2 kids, who are all naturalized citizens, remain in New York City.
I'm angry. I wish I had an invisible something. This can't be justice. It's just wickedness.
Today, more than 22,000 immigrants remain in detention. That's up from 6,000 just 10 years ago. And detention is showing no signs of slowing. An intelligence bill that passed Congress in 2004 authorized the construction of an additional 40,000 beds. And not only is detention a primary element in interior enforcement of immigration law, as in Patrick's case, it's also the central piece to the president's Secure Border Initiative, which he introduced last year. 2,500 beds have been added since last year. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Head of Detention, John Torres, talks about the recent developments this year.
Basically, this summer alone, we've been able to add an additional 3,000 beds, breaking that out some in El Paso, San Antonio. We added some beds in Port Isabel, but most importantly, within 45 days, we were able to establish 500 beds in Willacy, County, Texas, down in Raymondville, which is unprecedented in the prison industry. And within the next week or two, we'll be adding an additional 500 beds. By the end of September, that facility will be 2,000 beds. So just in the southwest border alone, especially in South Texas, we've added a significant detention space.
And Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff says that focusing on increased detention space is working. DHS now has places to hold immigrants who are caught crossing the border until they're processed and can be sent back to their country.
Taking together these statistics, ending catch and release, non-Mexicans down crossing the border and Mexicans down crossing the border demonstrate a change in the direction and a change in the momentum.
More detention beds means more government contracts. In addition to the beds that are already planned to be open this year, contracts worth several $100 million will be awarded by the end of September for more beds. Prison companies such as Corrections Corporation of America are sure to profit. Attorney Chris Nugent says it's big business.
Detention is a cash cow at this point.
It costs the government $80 to $90 per day per immigrant per bed. And detention is only one small aspect of the privatization of border security. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And that was Free Speech Radio News, Leanne Caldwell, with a report on expanding immigration detention centers and how they've become profitable for the prison industry. You're listening to Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And we're going to go now to a song by David Rovix. And he's just put out a new CD called Halliburton Boardroom Massacre. And he's going to be playing a part of his CD release tour this Friday, September 22nd at the Maritime Labor Center here in Vancouver. That's 1880 Triumph Street. That's at Victoria and Triumph. The doors open at 7 and the show's at 8 o'clock and the tickets are only $10. And this is sponsored by stopwar.ca. So this is the title track to his new song. And if you want to listen to his songs or download any of his songs, you can do so at his website, davidrovics.com. And his last name is spelled R-O-V-I-C-S. And this is his track, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre, on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM. And that was David Rovics off his latest CD, Halliburton Boardroom Massacre. And he's playing this Friday at the Maritime Labor Center here in Vancouver. More information, you can check out stopwar.ca. And September 12th was Leonard Peltier's birthday. That was just last week, and he turned 62 years old. And Leonard Peltier is a political prisoner who's been in jail in the United States for more than 30 years now. And he was he's an Indigenous rights activist and a member of the American Indian Movement. And he was wrongfully convicted back in 1975 after some shootout and activities at the Pine Ridge Reservation in the United States. So we're going to go now and hear, this is actually him. I've never heard audio from him on the internet before. So when I came across this, I wanted to share it with other people. And also that the technical part of it is not super, but I think it's really powerful to hear his voice. So this is some Leonard Peltier in honor of his 62nd birthday here on Co-op Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Sisters, brothers, friends, and supporters. Well, here it is, another year. Another birthday. This one makes me 62 years old. Also, this makes it my 30 plus years in prison. I believe it was right after I was illegally convicted in Fargo, North Dakota, when I wrote a statement telling everyone that my freedom would only come after the masses had demanded it. But first, we would have to unite and organize to reach them. So far, we have been unable to do so. Yes, we have reached millions who signed my petitions. We circulated throughout the world, asking for my release. True, most of those good peoples are from Europe. But we also made a lot of gains here in the United States. At one time,
We had 55 members of Congress sign a letter for a new trial or my release. 55 members is historical. No other prisoner in history has ever been able to accomplish this, nor has anyone else individually. And there are other accomplishments we have made and won here in the United States. Still, I sit in prison, not because I am guilty of the alleged crime I was illegally convicted of, but because we are still unable to reach the masses here in America. The reasons for this is not because the American peoples do not care or want to help, but because we have been unable to reach them. Personally, I believe the majority of them do care and want to help. We sense this from the ones we are able to reach. We are moving forward very slowly in this freedom campaign of mine. The reason for this is we just do not have the financial resources to move forward at the pace we would like to be. This is the real and only reasons we have been unable to reach the peoples of the United States. Nothing is free here in America, not justice or the media. So although there still is no light at the end of the tunnel for me or my freedom, we continue struggling forward. I continue to search for the hope and strength I need to survive. I continue to pray and hope that one day I will get the support I need from the American people, and one day I will still be able to walk out of prison. So my hopes and spirits are still high at my 62 years of age. I can tell you in this continued struggle, we are still finding bits and pieces of new evidence to file new appeals on. Those of you who have followed my case closely, I can imagine are thinking, how can this be, as there has been so many constitutional violations already? But the same old problem exists. The courts continue to cover up the criminal acts and my conviction committed by my prosecutors. Your help is still needed more than ever. Please give us all you can. Thank you. No shot in the spirit of crazy horse. Okay, we can go on to last Leonard Peltier.
And that was the voice of Leonard Peltier. And that was in honor of his 62nd birthday, which was September 12th of this year. And Leonard Peltier is still in prison in the United States, still a political prisoner. For more information on him, you can check out freepeltier.org. We're going to go now to a song by Submission Hold. They're a local band who aren't currently together, but this is their most recent or their last album, What Holds Back the Elephant, and this is the track Dirt. time for some community announcements here on Stark Raven. There is a march and rally in support of the Cuban Five. The Cuban Five are some political prisoners being held in U.S. jail. September 12th marks the 8th year of imprisonment. They're Cubans who are working to stop terrorism towards Cuba in the base of Miami. So Free the Cuban Five Committee Vancouver is organizing a rally in March, Saturday, September 23rd at 3 p.m. And surprise, it's at the Vancouver Art Gallery, Robson and Howe Street. It's a good place to assemble. They're marching to the U.S. consulate. You want more information, you can check out VancubaSolidarity.com.
All right, summer's not over yet. There's some great events happening at Grandview Park on September 21st and 27th. It's a event put on by No One Is Illegal, and it's a series of short films on migration, insecurity, and 9/11, Reels of Resistance, and Evening of Cinema in the Park. If you don't know where that park is, it's on Commercial Drive and Charles Street. It's where people drum and kids play. And
all kinds of things happen.
All kinds of things happened. And it's a free event, so check that out for sure. That's Tuesday, September 21st, Wednesday, September 27th, both at 7:30 p.m.
Yeah, that's this Thursday. And it's free, and films in the park, political films in the park. That sounds fun. So there is a School of Grassroots Organizing happening. It's the Organizing Center for Economic, Social and Economic Justice is organizing this. It's happening October to December. It's the school that was started by the Bus Riders Union. It's now being organized through the Center for Social and Economic Justice. So it combines theory and practice. It has a weekend and an 8-hour crash course, and then there's discussions every 2 weeks on various themes. And the participating groups are the Bus Riders Union and the Alliance for People's Health and Justicia for Migrant Workers BC. So the application deadline, if you're interested in being a participant in this school, is September 24th. And you should contact the Organizing Center for Social and Economic Justice, 215-2775. That's 215-2775. And that's all for Stark Raven for another week. Stay tuned now for Think Indian. And if you want to join Stark Raven's email list, you can email us at stark-raven@coopradio.org. And we've just started to podcast, so that's very exciting. You can find our podcast now, and you can email us if you're interested, stark-raven@coopradio.org. Our podcasts are at radioforall.net. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. Next week is Y57, the youth show on Co-op Radio. We're back on Monday, October 7th at 7 p.m. So stay tuned now for Think Indian, and we're going to hear a little more Submission Hold as we go out here. See you next time, and thanks, Marge, for being our guest host.
You're very welcome. Thank you.